over the last few decades, and they now have large cells operating in Portugal and Romania, as well as their main base of operations just outside Paris. They have become less of a family and more of a brotherhood.
Hang on, what are we talking about here? I said. Is this like the mafia kind of brotherhood or some kind of witch fraternity?
I was thinking more along the lines of the Freemasons, Jesse told me. But evil.
More evil?
The others ignored us. My aunt said they were even employing vampires now, Kirsten put in. Why do they care so much about expansion?
Will, who had been texting, probably to warn his pack about the Luparii, looked up and added,
Especially since the wolves have been staying out of Europe.
I wondered for the first time how dialed in he was to the other werewolf packs. Wolves are territorial by nature, and communication across large distances is difficult in the old world, because we don't exactly trust the internet or phone lines, and we're not allowed to bring any outside humans into the know. Did Will keep in touch with other alphas anyway? I'd never thought to ask.
What about the Luparii's ideology?
Asked Jesse. Out of all of us, he was probably the most accustomed to dealing with organized criminal wackos.
Has that changed, too? I'm not sure,
Dashiell admitted.
I know that they are still devoted to the eradication of werewolves. Still, as Kirsten said, I don't understand why they've been making a point to expand.
We were probably all thinking it, but it was Will who said, in a carefully level voice,
You didn't think it was necessary to tell us about any of this?
Dashiell didn't seem offended, which surprised me a little. He spread his hands.
In truth, I thought we were done with the Luparii. 3 years ago, when I negotiated with Aldrich, their leader, I was unaware of the organization's scope. By the time I found out that they had grown to a much larger force, we had already made the deal to keep Shadow in Los Angeles and allow Petra Corbett to take the fall for the Nova Wolf. And I haven't heard a word from them since then.
He shrugged, looking at me.
What is that phrase you've been using? Not my circus, not my monkeys?
I pushed out a breath, nodding. I could tell by the way he hadn't shot down Will for questioning him that Dashiell felt a little bad about not warning us. I couldn't find it in me to blame him, though, even though he'd come down on me hard about going to Colorado. Dashiell had been alive for over 100 years, and he could theoretically live forever. Of course he knew big-picture stuff he didn't tell us about.
So why make the deal with us in the first place? Kirsten asked, worrying at her bottom lip with her teeth. Why not just come here 3 years ago and put us in our place?
To buy time, I suggested.
Jesse nodded.
I agree. The timing of this latest attack is bothering me. Scarlet has never left Shadow with a human for more than an hour or two, and her trip to Colorado was unplanned.
He glanced sideways at me, and I nodded, confirming it.
I didn't care how good your evil empire is. No one could have known I was going to Boulder before I did. I doubt the Luparii witches randomly showed up the night Scarlet left town. It's too big of a coincidence. They've been watching her. There had to be a reason.
A chill spread through me. They'd been watching me? Watching the cottage? For how long? Since we captured Petra? I asked.
Jesse shrugged. There's no way to know for sure, but I doubt it. 3 years is a long time to surveil someone without them noticing.
I nodded, trying to push away the sensation that my skin was crawling with bugs.
Okay, so they've been keeping an eye on me, waiting for a chance to take Shadow. But they could have attacked well before now. I had no idea they were in town. I wasn't expecting it.
But if they put you out of commission first, Shadow wouldn't have gone willingly, and it would have tipped off Dashiell and the others to their presence, Jesse pointed out. That's why I think there's a larger plan here.
Explain,
Dashiell demanded.
Yeah, he was still mad.
Killian said something about them needing a couple of days, Jesse said. I think they originally planned something for a few days from now. Like I said, killing you and taking Shadow was just one part of that.
He glanced apologetically at me.
But then you left, and they panicked when they couldn't find you. They also probably saw an opportunity to remove Shadow from the equation early.
In a weird way, it actually made me feel a tiny bit better that the Luparii were planning something before I blew town. What had happened to Jesse was still my fault, but I didn't deserve credit for the entire mess.
Beltane is in a few days, Kirsten offered. Dashiell and Beatrice made little humming noises, but Jesse shot me a confused look.
It's the wheel of the year, I explained. Remember a few years ago when Olivia and Mallory attacked Kirsten's solstice party?
He nodded.
The winter solstice in December is the shortest night of the year. The summer solstice in June is the longest night of the year. If you picture the face of a clock with winter solstice at 12 and summer solstice at 6, that forms the wheel of the year.
Kirsten was watching me with a tiny amused smile, probably wondering how much I'd been listening all the time she'd needed to explain this to me.
A regular clock has 12 points on it, but the wheel of the year has 8, which are the 8 strongest times to use witch magic. Halfway between December and June is late March, which is called,
I looked at Kirsten for support.
Ostara, she supplied.
Right,
and halfway between Ostara and the summer solstice is Beltane, and that's in 2 days.
Ostara and Beltane are the pagan names from a Western European tradition, Kirsten added. Very few traditions celebrated all 8 holidays until as recently as the 1950s, when British pagans finally put the wheel of the year together. But they're a convenient shortcut to describe the days when magic is objectively the strongest all over the world, I broke in.
I knew from past experience that Kirsten could go on for hours about how different cultures used different witch traditions, and we didn't have that kind of time.
Bottom line, there's symbolism and there's what works. For whatever reason, those 8 days of the year work.
If they're planning something big with witch magic, they might be aiming for that night, Kirsten said.
Or they might be using it as a misdirect to attack the night before or after,
Dashiell pointed out. Well, whatever they might be planning, we need to find Shadow, I said, making eye contact with each of them.
Have you considered the possibility that they've already killed her?
Dashiell said, in a voice that was surprisingly gentle.
How? I asked. Short of a nuke, I don't know how you could kill a Bargast quickly. If the Luparii have a simple way to do it, they would have killed her back at the cottage and saved the trouble of transporting her.
What about drowning?
Will offered. He said it suspiciously fast, and I wondered how much time he'd spent thinking about how to kill Shadow.
How are you going to hold her under? I countered. She's dense, heavy, but she can swim, and she can hold her breath a long time. Even if they still have her in that metal net, they'd need a way to hold the net underwater. Otherwise, there's a good chance she could struggle out of it and kill them.
I took a deep breath and voiced my biggest fear.
Look, I've thought about this back when Shadow first came to me. As far as I can tell, there are 2 ways to kill her. One would be to undo the Bargast spell, but that requires a human sacrifice and a whole bunch of competent witches, not to mention some of the nightshades. It's complicated. The other way, my voice suddenly caught in my throat,
would be to starve her,
Jesse finished for me. His voice was grave. I nodded.
She needs food and water like any other living creature. Her body requires fuel, and lots of it. It can heal itself, so she can probably last longer than ordinary dogs, but eventually she's going to dehydrate or starve. All they have to do is put her in a cage somewhere and leave her.
My voice was starting to tremble, so I forced myself to remember who I was talking to. Dashiell didn't care about Shadow the way I did. I needed to use the things he did care about. I lifted my chin and looked at him directly. "There's no reason for them to fly her back to Europe to starve her," I told him. "Shadow is a powerful weapon, and I think she's still here, at least in California." He nodded, understanding.
"We may be able to recover her, and if they leave behind a group of witches to guard her, as I would do in their place, we can catch some of those who did this." "All right. We go after Shadow."
He bared his teeth in what was really not a very nice smile. He was human in my presence, so it wasn't vampire scary, but it was still Dashiell scary.
"Where do we begin?"
Chapter 18.
Where do you begin looking for a kidnapped dog monster?
My first thought was to try and trace the equipment necessary to contain a Barghest, but that metal net Jesse had described wasn't something you could get in L.A. The werewolves would have found out by now and raised a stink, which meant they'd brought their own gear. And if they were planning to starve her to death, there was no point in trying to trace purchases of her specialized food. That left trying to figure out where the Luparii might be staying, but we didn't have any confirmation that they were still in L.A. County, and even if they were, thanks to Airbnb and the like, they could be anywhere. We didn't even know how many people the Luparii might have brought with them to Los Angeles. Dashiell said he would spend the remainder of the night looking at ways in and out of the city. Given the heavy equipment, it seemed likely that the Luparii had arrived by private plane or ship, and Dashiell did a lot of business at the ports. And Kirsten agreed to put out feelers among her various contacts in the witch community, both here and in Europe. She'd also put all of her witches on alert for the Luparii magic. Will would be busy trying to evacuate as many of his werewolves as he could from L.A. County, but he'd also have a couple of his best pack members sniff around, starting near the cottage and where Kirsten and Hayne had found Jesse's unconscious body. They all knew Shadow's scent. Even so, I didn't have much hope for that panning out. Los Angeles was an insane amount of ground to cover. Which left Jesse and me. I was ready to start driving around the city with my head out of the window screaming Shadow's name, but Jesse suggested that we interview a friend of his who worked at the prison, in case the Luparii had left any evidence behind. Short of a hotel room key or a signed confession, I had no idea how that was going to help, but neither of us had any other ideas, and sitting at the cottage worrying about Shadow wasn't going to get me anywhere. And so everyone went about wasting the day. Jesse and I went down to Corona and met his friend Dan Cohen over early morning coffee, but he couldn't help much. He did tell us one thing that was being kept from the press. One of the other guards had walked Petra into the minimum security part of the prison and basically waved her goodbye, all of which appeared on the surveillance footage. That same guard, Cohen said, now claimed he had no memory of why he'd done it. I looked at Jesse, who nodded to say he got it too. The guard had probably been pressed by a vampire, which confirmed what Kirsten had heard about the Luparii. They were expanding their ranks. Jesse asked Cohen if Petra had left anything behind in her cell, and he frowned.
"I work in a different area, but I filled in a couple of shifts on that ward," he said. "That chick was an ice queen. No personal effects, no books, nothing. She was careful and scary. Every other woman in there left her alone, which is saying something."
"Did she have computer privileges?" Jesse asked. "Visitors?"
Cohen shrugged.
"They're looking into that now, but there certainly wasn't anything that stood out as unusual. In a way, she was a model prisoner. Left everyone alone, didn't cause trouble, but she creeped everyone out. She didn't even have a cellmate, because they kept trying to commit suicide."
Jesse and I exchanged a look. The Luparii magic tended to twist things toward evil. Why not minds?
Cohen interpreted our expressions and said emphatically,
"Yeah, see what I mean? Creepy."
So the prison was a dead end. At noon, we checked in with Kirsten and Will, who were both busy dealing with informants and or panicky werewolves, and didn't have any new information on Shadow. I was racking my brain for ideas about finding Shadow, but I kept coming up empty. Finally, we went back to the cottage. I kept my radius expanded so I'd have plenty of advance warning if the Luparii decided to try another run at me, and started making calls. Jesse phoned his old contacts at various police stations to ask them to call if there were any sightings of a very unusual dog or noise complaints about a bark loud enough to shake the ground. I called shelters. It seemed like a very long shot, but Shadow was as smart as some people, with magic-enhanced strength and healing. I had to believe there was a chance she could get away from the Luparii on her own. At 7:45, shortly after sunset, Jesse and I were sitting in my living room, trying to figure out our next move. I had just gotten off the phone with Dashiell.
"Any new info?"
Jesse asked. I shook my head. "More of a confirmation. The vampires in Europe have noticed that the Luparii are expanding. They've kept an eye on it, but the Luparii have made it clear that their continued goal is eradicating werewolves."
"So the European vampires don't really care?"
Jesse concluded. "Exactly." He opened his mouth, but his cell phone rang before he could say anything. He checked the screen and then paused, frowning like he couldn't decide whether to answer. "Who is it?" I asked.
"A former friend,"
he said briefly, and answered the phone.
"This is Jesse Cruz."
Then he listened for a long time, interjecting only the occasional, "mm-hmm," or,
"yeah, probably."
At one point, he looked at me and made a little writing motion, and I got him the pen from the coffee table. He scribbled something on the palm of his hand. Finally, Jesse hung up and turned to me, looking grim.
"There was a murder in Long Beach that could be supernatural,"
he reported. I needed a second to take that in. His friend was in the know and worked with the LAPD. While helping Hain with his security measures, I knew the very short list of humans who were allowed to know about the old world despite not being attached to it. And one of them was a criminologist in Jesse's old division. "Is this Gloria Sherman?"
"Yes."
Jesse looked tense.
"Years ago, Dashiell told her to call me if she got a case that looked supernatural. But I haven't actually heard from her since the Luparii murders."
"Huh." That didn't surprise me, given how quiet things had been in L.A. Well, maybe not quiet, so much as we keep our shit contained. Then a terrible, terrible thought struck me. Are there jaws missing? Back when the Luparii were hunting wolves for the King of France, they would save the wolves' jaws as proof of death. On the Luparii's last visit to L.A., they'd killed two of Will's werewolves and taken their jaws. Shadow had killed them. Were the Luparii making her kill again? Before I could follow that thought down the inevitable rabbit hole, Jesse said,
No, he definitely wasn't mauled."
"Then how did he die?"
He made a face. "By beheading."
"Oh, gross. Who does that?"
He glanced at me, a little amused.
"I was going to ask you the same question,"
he said.
"Even in a city with as much crime as L.A., you don't get a lot of people who die by beheading. Sometimes a body will be decapitated in a traffic accident, or someone will cut a head off after death, but it's really hard to kill someone by chopping off their head. Even if you've got them unconscious, there are easier ways to do it."
"What's the victim's name?" Jesse checked his hand, where he'd written the name.
"Carl Schmidt."
I turned the name over in my mind for a few minutes, but came up with nothing. "Never heard of him, but I'll check with the others." I texted Dashiell, Kirsten, and Will. Neither Kirsten nor Will had heard of Carl Schmidt. Dashiell called me back about 10 minutes later. I put him on speakerphone at his request.
"I don't know this Carl Schmidt," he said crisply, "but I have arranged for the two of you to go look at his residence."
I was surprised that he was taking the whole beheading thing so seriously. "Do you mean you want us to go see the body?" I asked. "My understanding is that it's at the coroner's building now."
"I spoke to the coroner," he said curtly. "The body has gone through a preliminary examination, but they are unable to do the autopsy until the morning. There is nothing to see except a naked body and a detached head."
"What about defensive wounds?"
Jesse asked.
"There were none."
Jesse's eyes widened.
"That's unusual. Which is one of the reasons why I'm sending you two down there."
Dashiell was starting to sound impatient with us.
"The house is your best source of information. I have arranged for one of the forensics people to meet you there and walk you through the scene. I will also send a vampire so you can erase his memory, and the memory of anyone else you need to speak to."
Ugh. This was annoying, though not really unexpected. Most of the time, my job didn't involve human witnesses. Or, rather, they'd already been pressed and sent home by the time I was called in. But from time to time, I dealt with a situation that was still ongoing and required the aid of vampires. "Can it just be Molly?" I tried not to sound whiny, considering the thinness of the ice I was standing on. "I hate working with people I don't know."
There was a long pause.
"No,"
Dashiell said finally.
"I think you and Molly have had enough adventures for one weekend. Don't you?"
His voice hardened with every word. I winced. He didn't want Molly and me colluding, or conspiring, or whatever C-word meant we weren't team players. I was irritated by the lack of trust, but I also kind of deserved it. Either way, I wasn't stupid enough to answer him. Go me.
"However," Dashiell went on, "considering the current circumstances, I concede that you'd do well with an ally at your side. I'll call Wyatt."
I brightened. Wyatt was the cowboy vampire I'd brought back with me from Vegas. Only 6 weeks ago, he'd been suicidal after the death of his wife, but since coming to Los Angeles, he'd found a job and a place in Dashiell's service. I went and checked on him a couple of times a week at the bar where he worked, and he seemed to have found a degree of peace. He'd even stopped announcing his running countdown of the days left before my agreement to kill him kicked in.
Long story.
"What about Shadow?" I said.
"Everyone will continue their current efforts, Scarlet. But until we get more information, there's not much else we can do,"
he said, not unkindly.
"Get back to me when you know whether or not this murder is old world."
I wondered if he was sending us to a crime scene just to keep me busy, so I'd stop pestering him about the search. But he was right. I couldn't think of anything else to do. After we hung up, Jesse looked at me.
"So he can just arrange a tour of an active LAPD crime scene?"
I shrugged. "The man has juice." We got ready to leave, which felt strange without Shadow hanging out by my leg, nudging my thigh to remind me that she wanted to come too. After I grabbed my keys and jacket and made sure I had a knife in each boot, we headed out to my van, the White Whale. I started toward the driver's seat, then stopped in my tracks, putting a hand on the hood. The morning sickness was making itself known again.
"Change of plans," I mumbled, holding out the keys.
"You drive." He didn't comment, but when we got on the road, Jesse pulled into a gas station instead of heading for the freeway. The tank was already pretty full, but before I could ask what he was doing, he was out of the van and jogging into the store. He returned a few minutes later with a small box of saltines.
"You need to eat,"
he ordered, thrusting the crackers at me.
"Damn it! You too?"
The whole idea of eating was repulsive at the moment. but I reluctantly tore open the package and bit off a cracker. It tasted like crunchy dust, but I kept mechanically chewing away. "So what's the significance of no defensive wounds?" I asked. Dashiell seemed surprised, and your eyes went all, "Oh."
"I've never had a beheading case, but we studied one at the academy," Jesse replied. "Let's say I've got an axe."
I blinked, swallowing a chunk of wet sawdust. "Sure. A kind of a left turn there, but fine. Axe."
"If I swung it toward your neck, what would you do?"
He took his right hand off the wheel to pantomime the swing. I thought for a second. "Step into the swing so I'm too close for you to use the axe.
And that's not a bad choice, but then I could punch you, and you'd stagger back far enough for me to cut off your head."
I nodded, understanding. "Which would at least give me a bruise. What if I grabbed for the axe?"
"You'd probably get in the way of the blade and get cut. If you tried to wrestle it away from me or hit me, that would show up somewhere. Abrasions on your hands, cuts on your knuckles, something."
"What if I never saw you coming?" I suggested. "Axe ninja?"
"That's pretty much the only possible way. But it takes a lot of force to remove someone's head in one clean blow. Unless the killer is a complete badass with brass balls, he probably wouldn't use enough force on the first pass. He'd have to hack at you, and if you could move at all, you'd get your hands up and your fingers would get cut. Or you'd try to crawl away from him, which would likely result in carpet burns or broken fingernails. Defensive wounds."
"Huh." I thought that over for a few seconds. "Not if I was unconscious. Or pressed," I reminded him. "It seems possible if there's a vampire involved."
"Maybe one of the Luparii's vampires?"
he suggested. I groaned. "God, I hope not. That would really be the pickle on this shit sandwich of a situation." Chapter 19. Half an hour later, I threw my arms around a tall, lean vampire with a mustache that looked like it had arrived from 1890 in a time machine. Jesse and I had parked just down the block from the crime scene house, and Wyatt pulled up behind us a second later, ambling over to greet me in his long duster jacket and cowboy hat, his big handlebar stash turned up in a smile. I jumped out of the van and hurried over to him. I'm not generally a hugger, but Wyatt always seemed like he needed it, and he was sort of my responsibility. I stepped back and looked at Jesse. "Wyatt, this is my friend Jesse." "Jesse? Wyatt." The men gave each other nearly identical wary looks, and then Wyatt looked down at me with concern.
"Miss Scarlet, are you all right? You look a little peaked."
"I'm fine, Wyatt.
Let's get this over with."
I stepped toward the house, then paused and looked back at him. "There might be a lot of blood in there, and I'll need to shrink my radius so you can press the human. Did you, already eat tonight?" Wyatt looked surprised, but gave me his slow, lazy grin.
"Yes, ma'am. Don't you worry about that."
We trooped toward the house, a yellow stucco bungalow, with crime scene tape wrapped on little sticks to block off the whole yard. The yard itself was tiny, maybe 10 square feet total, with some of those goddamned bird-of-paradise plants lining the little footpath leading to the front step. I hate those flowers. They always look like they're about to come to life and peck me to death. At the very least, they're all definitely planning something. There was someone waiting on the front stoop, a black guy in his late 30s, short and lithe-looking. He stood up as we approached, and his eyes narrowed.
"Jesse Cruz?"
he said, in a voice with a soft southern accent. I looked at Jesse out of the corner of my eye and caught the way his shoulders slumped.
"Hey, Aaron. I didn't know you were working this case. How's it going?"
The other man ignored the question, looking pointedly at Wyatt and me.
"And who are you?"
J. Aaron, this is Scarlett, and that's Wyatt, Jesse said. Aaron is a crime scene investigator. Aaron made no effort to shake hands.
I was here from 11 o'clock this morning until half an hour ago. Then I got called to come back and show around some consultant team, he said coldly, his gaze moving back to Jesse.
That your new gig?
Consulting?
He managed to imbue that one word with an impressive amount of scorn. Jesse started to answer, but Wyatt glanced at me. I nodded and shrank my radius down to a couple of feet. Wyatt stepped forward, making eye contact with Aaron.
You don't want to ask us any more questions about why we're here,
he said smoothly.
You want to take us inside now.
Aaron blinked a couple of times, then turned to the door.
Right. Let's head in.
Behind his back, Jesse shot both of us a glare, but I shrugged, unrepentant. We were going to erase this guy's entire memory of us anyway. Might as well move things along. Besides, he was kind of being an asshole. We put on gloves, hairnets, and booties. Wyatt had to take off his cowboy boots to get his on. And then Aaron led us silently through the tiny foyer into a small, tidy living room that had last been decorated in the late 70s. There were splashes of blood everywhere, but they were especially concentrated around a blue velvet lazy boy. Jesse went straight toward it, then looked quizzically over his shoulder at Aaron.
Was he sitting in the chair when someone cut off his head?
No.
Aaron still looked sullen.
Blood spatter indicates he was kneeling in front of the chair.
Not unconscious, then.
Clean slice, or was there hacking?
Jesse asked.
One slice,
Aaron said, with the tiniest bit of relish in his voice. While Jesse questioned Aaron, Wyatt leaned sideways in the doorway, where he had a clear view of both the living room and the foyer with the front door. His job wasn't detecting clues, so much as watching our backs and pressing Aaron when we were done. He caught me glancing at him and gave me a slow wink, his mustache turning up at the ends as he grinned at me. I smiled back. It was good to be working together again. I turned back to the living room. I wasn't sure how useful I would be on the clue front either, since all my experience with crimes involved trying to destroy them. But I wandered around the room, taking it in. I kept an ear on Jesse's conversation with Aaron, but the forensic details didn't really interest me. Besides, Jesse would translate the information into whatever I needed to know. When you got past the death stench, the whole room had an underlying smell that I naturally associated with old man. Carl Schmidt had been in his 80s, which made his odd death even stranger. If you wanted to kill a man that old, there are 100 easier ways to do it, all of which would get less interest from the police. I scanned the titles on the bookshelf, which looked like standard old man picks, Louis L'Amour, Agatha Christie, and a decent amount of nonfiction covering two subjects, baseball and World War II. At the end of the shelf, I picked up a photograph in a simple oak frame. An elderly man sitting at a picnic table, the kind of thing they had at every public park in L.A. He was surrounded by children, mugging on the bench next to him, laughing at his feet, even a couple hanging over his shoulder. The youngest, a girl of about 3, sat in his lap looking content as hell. Schmidt and his grandchildren, probably. I counted 12 of them, ranging in age from toddlers to maybe 20 or 21. I studied Schmidt's face. While the children had light brown skin, he was alabaster pale, with faded blue eyes sunk into a deeply wrinkled face. He appeared to be in very good shape for his age. I could see the muscle definition on his forearm, where it was looped carefully around the girl in his lap. The old man was smiling, but it was a worried, protective smile. Like he needed to stay on guard, lest someone run up and snatch the children away from him. I realized that the voices behind me had risen in volume, and I turned around. Aaron and Jesse were still standing near the armchair, but their body language was combative,
which you'd know if you hadn't decided to cash out of doing your job. Aaron was snapping.
Jesse didn't take the bait, but he looked like he was losing patience.
You know this isn't about that, isn't it?
Aaron waved his arms to indicate the room.
How do I know you're not just here to write a sequel?
Wyatt was raising his eyebrows at me from the doorway, asking if it was time to press Aaron. Jesse caught the look and shook his head.
I just want to understand,
he said to Aaron.
Schmidt was sitting in the chair, watching TV, and someone came in and made him kneel down so they could behead him.
But what was the weapon?
You tell me, super cop,
Aaron said snidely, crossing his arms over his chest.
Okay, that's enough,
I said, rolling my eyes. Wyatt, if you would help Mr. Aaron with his cooperation skills? I pulled in my radius. Wyatt, now a vampire again, took a step toward Aaron. But he paused, his nostrils flaring briefly. I was about to ask, but he shook his head a little and advanced on the criminologist, who shrank away from him, backing up toward my end of the room. Unfortunately for Aaron, eye contact was all Wyatt needed.
Answer our questions,
he said in a perfectly level voice, his eyes drilling into Aaron's.
And keep a civil tongue in your head.
The smaller man went sort of slack, then nodded. Jesse sighed, not liking any of this. I couldn't really blame him.
What kind of weapon was used?
He asked.
An axe?
No,
Aaron said in a wooden voice, his eyes locked on Wyatt.
We have to do further testing, but the angle of blood spatter suggests some sort of machete or sword.
Jesse and I exchanged a bewildered look. A sword? Like an actual motherfucking sword? I knew lots of vampires who carried knives so they could make a quick little cut to feed from instead of using their teeth. But a sword was impractical and raised too many questions. Everyone in the old world took pains to blend in, not stand out. This whole thing felt fishy.
Was the lock on the front door damaged?
Jesse asked Aaron next.
No.
Did you find any physical evidence from the suspect?
There were several sets of fingerprints, but no hair or fibers that didn't come from the victim.
Aaron replied, still in that unsettling monotone.
Who's in charge of the case?
Abramowitz.
Jesse gave a tiny head shake, mostly to himself. He didn't know the name.
Is he any good?
No, not really.
The answer came as fast and dispassionate as the others, and for some reason I had to stifle a snort. Jesse looked at me and shrugged, done with questions.
Okay, Wyatt, I said in a low voice, but he didn't break the press yet.
Did your people find the drops of blood in that corner of the room?
Wyatt asked, pointing toward the doorway where he'd been standing.
Yes. Whose blood is it?
We don't know. Same blood type as Schmidt, but we don't know how it could have gotten all the way across the room. We'll know more when the DNA goes through.
Wyatt looked at me, which broke the press.
That blood isn't Schmidt's,
he said quietly. Aaron was swaying a little, looking unmoored.
How do you know?
I asked Wyatt. The vampire went back to the corner and put his nose right over the carpet, taking a long inhale.
It is male,
he reported.
But it's young. I can smell the hormones.
He sat back on his heels.
I can also smell the magic in it.
Aaron's confused face somehow clouded over even more.
Magic?
I ignored him, focused on Wyatt. Are you saying... He was already nodding.
Witch blood.
I had no idea what that meant, but there wasn't much else we were going to learn from that house, so Wyatt took Aaron out to his car to get a new evidence seal and to do his final press on Aaron's memory. Jesse and I waited in the house so he wouldn't spot us after he'd been pressed. You okay? I asked Jesse when we were alone. He was kind of a dick to you.
Jesse nodded.
Most of the cops feel like that,
he said, peeling off his gloves with great concentration.
They think I'm a traitor, that I sold out for money and fame, which is only half right, I guess.
I stepped closer to him, forcing him to look down at me. His eyes were sad. I thought you were going to be done with all that, I reminded him. The pity party ended ages ago. He sighed.
This isn't me feeling sorry for myself, Scar. I'm just...
guilty? He scrubbed the palm of his hand through his short hair.
More sad, I guess. I really liked being a cop.
Before I could think of a response to that, he changed the subject.
Male witches are pretty rare, right?
Yeah. I need to call Kirsten and find out if the witch who was here tonight was part of her group, but... I made a face. I think I would remember seeing a teenage male witch at one of their gatherings. As much as I hate to say it, I think this may be connected to the Luparii thing after all. They could have brought the witch with them.
Then how was he injured?
No idea. Wyatt knocked on the door to give the all clear, and Jesse and I went out onto the front step. Wyatt handed Jesse the new seal, and he spent a lot of time putting it up, very focused on getting the lines exactly right. I edged sideways a little so I could see his face in the dim lights from the street. He looked distraught. I was missing something. Jesse, what else did you see in your dream? He flinched away from me, as though I'd struck him across the face. But didn't answer.
Shit. I'd been right.
Wyatt looked back and forth between us for a moment, and then wandered into the tiny side yard, pretending to be interested in the creepy-ass plants. You said they were rifling through your memory, I said softly to Jesse, but not where you were or what you saw.
I'm sorry. I should have asked.
For a moment, Jesse looked like he was going to answer, but then he just shook his head tightly. Impulsively, I stepped forward and hugged him, breathing in his scent.
Stupid baby hormones.
Jesse hesitated for a second, and then his arms went around me. We stayed like that for a long moment. I hoped that the shadows would hide us from the occasional car driving past. When he finally stepped back toward the door, his eyes were just a tiny bit pink.
What now?
He said. He obviously didn't want to talk about the Luparii's attack anymore. I pushed out a breath, increasing the space between us a little. The car turned onto the street, and I realized we needed to get out of there before someone called the police. I'll make that call to Kirsten, just to cover our bases. Then we can check in with Dashiell and...
Scarlet!
Wyatt was suddenly running toward me with a wild look on his face. He slowed down when he hit my radius and then abruptly changed direction, heading across the yard instead of toward me. I stared at him, confused, until I finally registered that the car on the street had slowed down and the window was lowering. Jesse had put it together a half second before I did and was already pushing me down, but not fast enough. A quick pop-pop of gunshots rang out in the night. Chapter 20. I instinctively tried to reach for the knives in my boots, just as Jesse was shoving me toward the ground, and the two of us ended up going down in a tangle, my shoulder scraping hard against one of the narrow pillars framing the front door. Jesse drew his gun from a side holster, propped himself on his elbow, and began firing at the car's open passenger window, causing the driver to peel away down the street. The noise of Jesse's gun seemed deafening. When he was sure the car wasn't coming back, Jesse put the gun back in his holster and turned to me, yelling,
"Are you hit? Are you hit?"
"I think I'm okay," I mumbled, trying to disentangle my arms and legs. Then I saw Wyatt lying on the front lawn. He was on his back, his eyes closed, holding what looked like exit wounds in his stomach. That was when I realized he had changed his trajectory across the yard so he would be between the bullets and me.
Wyatt!
I fought the natural urge to run to him and instead began scooting away on my butt. I could still feel him in my radius, which meant he wasn't dead, but he would be if he stayed human. My response had been too quiet, so Jesse was still yelling at me, but I cut him off.
I'm fine! Wyatt jumped in front of the bullets. Help him!
So he stumbled to his feet and staggered toward Wyatt, pulling his jacket off along the way. I backed all the way off the front step and into the side yard until the birds of paradise leaves began pricking at the backs of my bare arms. Then I hugged my knees to my chest, closed my eyes, and concentrated as hard as I could on shrinking my radius away from Wyatt. It was more difficult than it should have been. When I'm overwhelmed by emotion, aka any time I totally lose my shit, my radius flares outward. Getting shot at certainly qualified as overwhelming. On top of that, the nausea was flaring back to life, but I could not throw up at a crime scene. I just couldn't. I tried to slow down my breathing. Think through it, Scarlet. I had no doubt that the attack had been intended for me. Jesse had been behind me, closer to the house. If Wyatt hadn't gotten in between me and the car, I'd be the one bleeding out on the grass. I shivered. Okay, so someone had tried to kill me. I was protected in Los Angeles by Dashiell, so it was probably the Luparii, which meant they were still in town. Which meant Jesse had been right about them being committed to killing me. I just didn't really know why. Yeah, I had helped kidnap Shadow from them, but plenty of others had helped me do it. Why not take a run at Dashiell, or kill Jesse properly? Why was killing me worth the risk of sticking around now that they had Shadow? They'd found me at the crime scene, which meant they'd known I'd be coming. So they were involved with Carl Schmidt's murder, but why? Had they set up a random weird crime scene just to lay a trap for me? That seemed ridiculous. There were plenty of easier ways to trap me. They could have just pretended to be an animal shelter that had found Shadow, and I would have raced over without thinking. At the same time, though, I couldn't see any other reason for them to attack some elderly human in Long Beach who had no ties to any of us. I didn't get it. But I'd be willing to bet if we went and talked to Gloria Sherman in person, we'd find that a vampire had pressed her to call Jesse, or a vampire had pressed someone at the coroner's office to call in Gloria, knowing she would call Jesse and me. Vampires were working for the Luparii now, and the Luparii wanted to kill me. Therefore, non-Jesse humans couldn't be trusted.
Scar?
Jesse yelled from the front walkway. I stood up so he could see me, still holding in my radius.
Is he okay?
I'll be fine, Miss Scarlet,
Wyatt called back.
But do you hear that?
My ears were still ringing, but when I focused on listening, I heard it too. The sound of sirens in the distance. The damn neighbors must have called the police. I groaned. Between Wyatt pressing humans and Dashiell's influence with the LAPD, we could get out of this fairly easily, but it would take forever. I reached for my phone to call Dashiell, but it wasn't in my pocket. I'd been so pleased to see Wyatt that I'd forgotten to take it off the charger in the van when we arrived. God damn it. What a rookie mistake. Jesse had stood up and was hurriedly unbuttoning his shirt, which was stained with blood. I started toward the yard to get the phone, but there was no way to get down the walkway and through the metal gate without getting close to Wyatt, who was only now struggling to his feet. I stopped 10 feet away from him, my radius clenched tightly around me.
I left my cell in the van,
I told them, in a voice that was probably louder than it needed to be.
I need to call Dashiell and get us some help.
Here, use mine,
Wyatt offered, and tossed me a slim black iPhone.
I'll fetch yours while you make the call.
I wanted to protest that he was still healing from a bullet wound, but we didn't have time, so I shrugged to myself and tossed my van keys at him, pointing left down the street toward the White Whale. He turned to go.
And Wyatt?
He looked over his shoulder.
Thank you, I said. I know you moved into the path of those bullets.
The cowboy grinned.
You do keep things interesting, don't you, Miss Scarlet?
As Wyatt took off at a light jog, slow for a vampire, damned fast for a vampire healing from bullet wounds, Jesse wadded up his bloody shirt and put his jacket back on over his undershirt. He looked like he was about to audition for a mob movie in the early 90s.
That was Killian shooting at us, Jesse said grimly. I saw his face. Sabine was probably driving.
Shit. I turned my attention to Wyatt's unlocked cell phone. Dashiell's number was one of only a handful in the contacts folder. I touched the number and held the phone to my ear, waiting for him to answer. Wyatt was far enough ahead now for me to wander down the little walkway toward the sidewalk. I looked idly in the direction of the van, parked about half a block away.
Hello,
Dashiell said. The sirens were very close now. It's me, I practically yelled, but I was distracted by the van. If the cops saw Wyatt, they might stop to talk to him first. But they never had the chance, because as he opened the driver's door, it exploded outward in a dazzling burst of fire. Chapter 21. When the van door exploded outward, I instinctively dropped to the ground, feeling the rush of escaping heat. It wasn't as big or colorful as a movie explosion, but that somehow made it even worse, more real and terrifying. As soon as I could, I staggered upright.
Wyatt!
I screamed, lurching toward the van. It looked like a giant had wrapped one enormous hand around it and squeezed. Bright orange flames were rising from the shattered windows, and I couldn't see any sign of Wyatt. I ran into the street, vaguely aware of Jesse shouting something right behind me, trying to get me to stop. Neighbors were running out of their houses, many of them holding cell phones. Shit. Any second someone was going to start taping, if they hadn't already. But I still had to know. When I circled the van, I saw the body right away. Wyatt was lying face down in the street, his body blackened, his right leg completely missing. My searching eyes found it a few feet away, the pants leg still on fire. I skidded to a stop and closed my eyes, forcing myself to feel for Wyatt in my radius.
Scarlet! Jesse came panting up behind me. We have to...
Shh! I held out a flat hand to silence him. There. My eyes popped open as I felt the little spark of vampire magic. We have to run, I said, dazed. I was too upset. I couldn't rein in my radius. I needed to get farther away from Wyatt if he had any hope of making it. Jesse came around to my front, looking exasperated.
That's what I've been saying!
Grabbing my hand, he practically dragged me back toward the Schmidt house. There was a tiny amount of space between it and the building next to it, and he led me through the side yard, around to the next street. None of the neighbors were watching us. To them, we probably looked like two more spectators who'd run out after the explosion. Their attention was focused on the van and the body.
Oh, God.
Wyatt's body. When we were two streets away, Jesse slowed down and put his arm around me like we were just any couple out for a stroll. Now and then he would crane his head to see if we were being followed. I had dropped Wyatt's phone in the yard, and my own cell had exploded in the van, but Jesse still had his. When he was sure no one was tracking us, he called Dashiell. It probably should have been me, but I was too... Poor Wyatt. He'd gone through so much just to protect me. And now I had no idea if he was going to survive the next few hours, much less whether he'd be able to grow his leg back. Werewolves could do it, I knew, but why had I never thought to ask about vampire limbs? And what if Dashiell treated him, and he did survive? After losing his wife, Wyatt had wanted to die. Would he be angry if we didn't let him move on? And there was also my van. God, I loved that stupid van. I'd paid it off myself, one of the first adult things I'd ever done. I'd taken such pains with it, and now it barely qualified as scrap metal.
Okay, Jesse was saying into the phone.
I do.
I will.
Where do you suggest?
After a couple more minutes, he hung up the phone and looked down at me.
We're going to a hotel,
he announced.
Dashiell will send Molly over with some clothes, and he said you already have an extra phone at your place.
I nodded numbly. I'd trashed so many cell phones over the last few years that Abby had started buying them for me in bulk. Dashiell insisted on getting good ones. I'd once tried buying my own older model, but he insisted on good phones with GPS tracking. Dashiell was very big on GPS tracking.
Does he have people at the scene?
I managed to say. Jesse nodded.
When he heard Schmidt's house was in Long Beach, Dashiell put a couple of the vampires at the copper room on standby. They're already there talking to the cops. And they'll recover Wyatt.
Jesse hesitated for a moment, then added softly,
"Either way."
The copper room was a vampire hangout in Long Beach, only a couple of miles away. It was popular among the younger, newer vampires.
Okay,
I mumbled.
That's good, I guess. What does he want us to do?
Nothing for the next few hours, Jesse said. He said he'll be busy making sure everyone who witnessed it gets pressed to think the car fire was an accident. He wants to meet an hour before dawn. Meanwhile, we should get some rest.
Rest. It seemed like I'd been doing so much of that lately, but then I never seemed to get more than a couple of hours. It was taking its toll. Also, did pregnancy make women more tired than usual? I should have asked Molly for more of her what-to-expect knowledge before Lex pressed her. My thoughts wandered around like that for a few more minutes as we strolled along the sidewalk. Then a dark red Lexus pulled up alongside us, and Jesse steered me toward it.
I think this is our ride.
To my surprise, the car's driver was Beatrice, Dashiell's wife. She was wearing tight jeans and a blousy white shirt, which was about the most casual I'd ever seen her at night. She still had 5-inch stiletto heels, though, which clicked on the pavement as she came around the car and tossed Jesse the keys.
Hi, Bea,
I said. My voice came out woozy.
You got here fast.
I was at the harbor on business,
she said as she strode up to us. She paused, gave me a critical look, and took me by the shoulders.
You can't go into shock right now, Scarlet, she said sternly. Someone is trying to kill you. You must keep it together.
I blinked hard.
Someone is trying to kill me, I repeated. And Wyatt might die. My van is gone. My home isn't safe.
And you look terrible and smell like smoke, she added. But this list isn't helping you stay alive.
She pressed a rectangle of black plastic into my hand. Curious, I looked down and saw a very fancy-looking credit card.
It's a corporate card for a shell company, she said. For the hotel. Call Molly when you're settled. She can bring your things. Don't give her your room number over the phone. She'll call up from the lobby.
I had lost the thread of the conversation by then, but Beatrice looked at Jesse.
Get her out of here. Keep her safe. How will you...
Jesse began, but then a second Lexus, this one black, pulled up behind Beatrice's car. She had a security team with her, of course. I couldn't see the driver through the tinted glass, but Beatrice was already waving us on.
Go! Now!
Jesse drove us to the biggest hotel nearby, the Long Beach Hyatt. I don't remember anything about checking in or getting up to the room. The next thing I really registered was Jesse handing me a robe and pushing me into a bathroom with shiny new fixtures. I showered and washed my hair, letting the hot spray blast me in the face, and by the time I stepped out, I felt almost like myself again. Well, really, really exhausted and worried version of myself, anyway. When I finally emerged, Jesse stood up from the side of the bed where he'd been staring down at his phone.
He looked tired and grubby, and there was a smudge of dirt or ash on one cheek. He'd thrown the button-down shirt in the garbage can outside before we came in, and the muscles in his chest stood out against his gray T-shirt. He stood right in front of me, assessing me with worried eyes. It kind of took my breath away.
"Are you okay?"
he asked.
"Not really.
Any word on Wyatt?"
Jesse shook his head.
There was a moment of painfully awkward silence, and then I blurted, "There's, only one bed."
I immediately felt stupid.
We'd shared a bed the night before, but that had been sort of an accident. This was a choice.
"Yeah," Jesse said, one hand lifting to scrub his palm through his hair. "They have some kind of convention here this weekend. There wasn't a double queen room, but I can take the pull-out couch."
"Scarlett." He stepped forward and grasped me around the waist, steadying me, and I realized I'd been swaying.
"You should sleep,"
he said huskily. He sort of danced me over to the edge of the bed. When the back of my legs hit it, all the remaining strength seemed to leave my body. Jesse started pulling back the covers to tuck me in. "Why do they want to kill me?" I said, to no one in particular.
"Best guess, because you can stop whatever they're about to do," Jesse said, and his words chilled me. "But not without some rest. I'm going to take a shower now, okay?"
"Jesse." I caught his wrist, and he turned to look down at me, surprised. I tried to figure out what I wanted to say, but all that came out was, "Sleep in the bed." He looked at me for a long moment, the light from the hallway casting a shadow on half his face.
"I don't know if that's..."
Oh, God, how I didn't want to hear the end of that sentence. "Please?" He bent and kissed my forehead, creating a spot of warmth that spread down to my stomach.
"Okay."
Chapter 22. It was only a little after 9, but by the time Jesse came out of the shower, Scarlett was fast asleep at the edge of the bed. She hadn't moved. The hotel phone rang, and Jesse hurried around the bed to answer it, although he doubted there was much that would wake Scarlett just then. It was Molly, as he'd expected. He gave her the room number, and a few minutes later, there was a soft knock on the door. "Nice robe," she said, as soon as he opened the door. She wore jeans and a tight tank top, her blonde curls bouncing against the large designer backpack on her shoulders. She moved past Jesse into the room before he could respond. "How is she?"
"Sleeping. Don't you have to ask permission to enter?" he said, slightly annoyed.
Jesse turned and followed her toward the sleeping Scarlett. "Har har! Not for a one-night stay. If you lived here for months and made it your home, maybe." Molly's appearance changed subtly as she hit Scarlett's radius, but she was used to it and took it in stride. "Damn, she looks like shit. Aren't you feeding her?"
"Shh, you're going to wake her up."
"Nah, she sleeps like the dead, and I would know." Molly gave him a wide grin and a little "see what I did there" look and took off the backpack. "Clothes for both of you, I guessed on your size."
"Thank you," he said, accepting the bag.
"Her new bat phone is in there, too. I texted the number to Abby so she can do her phone magic on it."
"Did you bring Scarlett's knife belt?"
Molly frowned. "Sorry, no. I was just told the clothes and the phone."
Jesse nodded. They'd figure it out in the morning. "What about you?" he said. "You know the cottage isn't safe right now."
"It's okay. Dashiell has a safe house with a basement in Arcadia. I'll still be close if Scar needs me."
"You've changed,"
Jesse blurted, surprising himself. Molly raised her eyebrows, and he shrugged, a little embarrassed.
I mean, a few years ago, when Scarlett got herself in deep shit, you left town for a few days."
"That was before," Molly said simply. She was still looking at Scarlett, fierce love written all over her face. "She's my sister now. Then she turned her gaze to Jesse. Besides, I'm not the only one. 3 years ago, you would have tried to convince her to take this mess to the police.
Jesse expected the words to sting, but he realized she was right and gave a little shrug.
Maybe.
Molly was watching him carefully. You're not going to ditch her again, are you?
Jesse started. I didn't... No, I'm not going to ditch her. I would never.
He regretted the two honest words as soon as they left his mouth, but Molly just started shaking her head.
You too, she grumbled.
What? Molly rolled her eyes and pointed both hands at Scarlett, then at him. You're in love with her. She's in love with you. But you dance around each other like you're in orbit because you're both too goddamn scared to do anything.
Shh.
Scandalized, he looked at Scarlett, who hadn't moved. Jesse grabbed Molly's shoulder and ushered her into the hallway, snagging his room key on the way. The hall was empty, but Jesse still cinched his robe a little tighter, which made Molly smirk. He pulled the door shut behind them.
You don't know what you're talking about,
he told her.
There's that guy, Jameson.
Jameson is dead, and she was never in love with him, Molly interrupted. She was in love with the idea of not being alone. But she never was alone. She's just an idiot. And so are you.
Jesse threw up his hands, exasperated. It probably didn't look very dignified, considering the hotel robe.
What do you care?
Human lives are short, dumbass, Molly said. She stabbed a finger toward the hotel door. She almost died twice today, and knowing you, when she does die, you'll be right there.